Yes, Evan Parker, and this is Dave Douglas. This is A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. I got a chance to talk to Evan Parker last month at the Royal Academy of Music in London, thanks to Nick Smart. Evan Parker is a great global musical citizen, and I got a chance to ask some questions that I had wondered about for a long time. We got pretty deep in the weeds, so I do hope you enjoy the interview and hearing Evan talk about his solo playing, his works for other performers, some of his background and how he developed such a unique saxophone style. And as always, we do list all the tracks of music that are played at our website, greenleafmusic.com. You can also go there to contact me. You can write to podcast@greenleafmusic.com and send comments and suggestions. I'm always very grateful and happy to hear from everybody and happy that the information is getting out there. So please do help us spread the word about this podcast and about Greenleaf Music. And please help us by subscribing. Become a subscriber and hear all of the music. A lot of it is exclusive to subscribers. And it helps me put this podcast together. Actually, I've been trying to stick to one episode a month. And as you know, I have not been able to keep up with that pace with all the traveling, the recording and projects. But I am going to continue to try talking to some of my favorite musicians in the world and sharing it with you. So thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Evan Parker. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Welcome. So we're like in a bunker here, right? In the bowels of the Royal Academy of Music. And with a bunch of great young musicians. We've been working all week on this piece, Eight Elements, and some big band works. And one of the most incredible details about this project this week has been the ability to invite this gentleman who's sitting here to join us and play, take part in the pieces themselves. But I think it's also, someone who's been so important to the movement of improvised music and jazz and creative thinking, not only in this country, but worldwide. So please help me welcome Evan Parker here.
I am not worthy, I know that, but...
Well, I'll get to that. I mean, yeah, neither of us have any credentials. Let me just say out front, I don't have an advanced degree, and I've been here... I mean, Nick Smart is out of the room, but I have no credential to be teaching these people. They know more about the music than I do. And we were talking last night, and you told me you really didn't either.
No.
So you never got a degree?
No. I was required to terminate my studies after the second year in a course in botany at Birmingham University. At the end of the first year, they said, "We don't know what's happened. You knew more botany when you arrived than you do now." And I muttered and mumbled about what's been an overwhelming experience being at university, meeting people in subjects I didn't know anything about, philosophy, economics, and blah, 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 blah. It's just been overwhelming. It's not that I haven't been interested in things. It's just that there's so many things. And blustered on, and they said, look, that's enough of that. if we give you another chance, will you stay on further and try and work harder next year? So I said yes, and they never saw me again. In those days, you got a grant. Remarkable idea, paying people to study. Perhaps my behavior was one of the reasons they stopped doing that. Never thought of it like that. You've got me to blame, among other things. But
what year would this be that you got kicked out of botany school?
Oh, that would have been about 62 or 63, I think. Yeah.
But it was the saxophone that was becoming your major.
Well, I was going to go on to say that in those days they gave you two terms grant in one lump at the beginning of the year. And then the third term was the third portion. So that first lump, I bought a Mark VI tenor. And I think it's the one that Stan Saltzman's playing now.
Wow.
I think so. He liked it a lot.
I had no idea that we owed so much to the field of botany.
So, just to set it in the right artistic frame, then I lived off the scraps in the, the refectory and that kind of thing. Lived a very frugal life, but got through the two terms and had the instrument, had practicing facilities there, other musicians to develop things with. And by the time I left Birmingham, I had pretty much three gigs a week. And there's another joke that I crack, but it may not go over too well, because it depends how much you know about Derek Bailey, my old nemesis, Derek Bailey. But he was famous for friend and nemesis, first friend, then nemesis. Famous for having done Sweet Charity, the musical, in the pit for Sweet Charity, with Shirley Bassey was in the lead in the West End production. And one of my three gigs in Birmingham involved playing in a club called the Elbow Room as a warm-up to Jim Capaldi's rock group. There was nobody there, nobody cared that we were playing, and at the other end of the room, the TV was on, because we started at the same time every Sunday, I think it was. Shirley Bassey was on the TV every Sunday. So I can also say I played with Shirley Bassey. Because they didn't switch the TV off there. They just let us get on with it down that end. Okay, these are the realities of the jazz in the 60s.
But you didn't really, you weren't in music school per se, and you never really did.
No, there was a music school just across the road from the student union. Mm-hmm. I went in there sometimes.
Yeah.
I had friends that were music students. But the piano player in my band was technically student.
I see. So maybe, would you say, were you already practicing obsessively at that time, saxophone?
Well, I suppose, that is the age when you can do that.
Yep.
Definitely, and you're so, I hope you're all aware of that fact. This is the time when you will be able to practice solidly. And you should do it, because that's the way you build the foundation of your future in music.
What was the information that you were practicing? If you didn't have any official teachers,
by that point, yeah,
were you listening to Coltrane and?
Yes, just trying to copy Coltrane, really. But the slightly easier modal period, from My Favorite Things onwards. Mm-hmm. And so I never really mastered running changes, 2-5-1s and all the stuff that's become the subject matter of jazz education these days, which has its pluses and minuses, but we'll probably get to that. Scales and arpeggios.
Uh-huh.
Practice in all keys, that kind of thing, yeah.
Would you say that the shapes of the way Coltrane was playing maybe was a big inspiration for you already at that time? Like, more, as opposed to the notes and arpeggios and scales, as you say, the actual, if you think of it like a drawing, the shapes, the ups and downs, the inner contours of the lines, which is something you went on to develop significantly. Yeah. Was that already part of your...
Well, I think it was the sheer power of presence in behind the sense of a person behind the instrument, speaking through the instrument, and immediately identifiable as that person.
Mm.
So absolutely the worst thing to do is try and copy Coltrane, because nobody's going to do it better than him. And
or John Arabica. What's interesting to me, and probably to a lot of people in this room, is just, you know, what do you work on, right? We're all sitting there in the practice room, and it's like after 2 minutes, I'm like, all right, I'm done. What should I work on now? You know, but for a lot of people, an hour, 2 hours, and then, like you just said a moment ago, you know, this is the time in your life when it really should be all day. You're just practicing obsessively. Yeah. So what do you work on? So when you say it's the power of the presence of the man standing behind the horn, and then in the next breath you say, well, there's no point in trying to imitate Coltrane.
Exactly. So I was half of my time I was wasting my time. And the other half...
By imitating Coltrane?
Well, not doing that great a job. The only advantage I had was at that point he wasn't the... excuse the cliche, iconic figure that he's become in the meantime. Mm. You know, he was just, and in fact, the thing was about Rollins, and it's amazing how it goes back. It's the same as Lester Young, Coleman Hawkins, which you prefer? Rollins, Coltrane, which do you prefer? Mm. And it was such a great thing when Joe Henderson came along, and you couldn't put Joe in, you could say, well, he's taken some of that, but which is he? It's almost like a religious affiliation that you had to make it clear. Yeah, I'm a Coltrane.
Am I in the Church of John?
I am in the Church of John.
Church of Sonny.
Yeah.
What about Wayne Shorter? Were you aware of his playing?
Yes, I was.
That was sort of a different camp too, wouldn't you say? Or was he more slotted into one?
Yeah, in fact, when I first came to London and started to play around, then people... although I thought I was doing a pretty good job of imitating Coltrane, people said I sounded more like Wayne Shorter, which was slightly irritating to me in a way, although it was a massive compliment. So,
but there's the famous Wayne, right? What they play comes from the same eggs. And then Wayne said, yeah, but it's how you scramble. Well, that's interesting. So now, okay, so we're... Let's just move up the timeline a little bit. Mm. You said when you got to London, which I guess is 66, 67, and you fell into a community of players who were looking at spontaneous improvisation and instant composition, for lack of better descriptors. And I don't want to say playing free, but yeah, examining the idea of what freedom is.
What's left to do, I think. But in fact, things were moving very fast at that point. When I and I should explain, the way I got introduced to John Stevens, the drummer, the legendary leader of many bands, but is most famous perhaps for the his version of the Spontaneous Music Ensemble, which started as a collective, but gradually John shouldered his way to the key position of decision maker. And one of the decisions he made was to give me a chance. I don't think anybody else would have been that generous.
Was early on the formation of SME, Spontaneous Music Ensemble, on that album that's been reissued now?
No.
What is it?
Carrie Oban.
Carrie Oban.
No.
So that was Derek Bailey, Dave Holland.
No, this is the key thing. When I arrived, Spontaneous Music was Trevor Watts, Kenny Wheeler, two different bass players, and John Stevens, Bruce Cale, uh-huh. I think it was a guy from New Zealand, maybe uh-huh. went on to work in the States. And who was the other guy? I think Jeff Klein may have played bass uh-huh. sometimes. Uh-huh. So they were playing, if you listen to the first record, it's called Challenge. And there's pieces by John, pieces by Trevor Watts, and one piece by Paul Rutherford. And
so it wasn't completely improvised.
I would say that John's pieces were influenced by Ornette,
mm-hmm.
Maybe Trevor's too, to some extent. So they were dealing with Ornette, and I think Paul Rutherford's piece was more George Russell, a little more through written, and mm-hmm. Just a little bit more sophisticated from the notation point of view. Then John and I got together, and everything went suddenly into total freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say that it was my idea. I was definitely just happy to be there. And to begin with, we did some structures that John had organized, and I think we played some lines of Trevor's and so on. And but then gradually that all slipped away. In fact, John fired everybody from the band except me and started again as a duo.
Hmm.
And when Carrie Oban, we made Carrie Oban, the second record from Spontaneous Music Ensemble, the functioning version of SME was a duo, John and me. And this was around the same time as Coltrane's last. Coltrane was still alive at that point. I think it was around the time of his duo, what's it called?
Interstellar Space
with Rashid Ali. And people assumed that, oh, this is, there's some connection. I think at the time we were already doing that before people knew the record, but they assumed that we'd heard about it, or mm-hmm. which wasn't the case. We weren't at that point doing anything except going into our own space, as far as we knew how to define it, by playing.
Was there any, recollect any outside influences that led you to take that move?
Well,
into no preconceived material.
Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't a matter of, it was largely, let's see what happens.
So you enjoyed it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we need any of this? I mean, there was a period where we did play some, we played some Coltrane tunes and with a bass player.
Wow.
But so this, when the recording opportunity came up, we had a conversation, and John, I think, took the lead in the conversation and said, look, this is a great opportunity. Shall we invite some other players?
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed between us that we would ask Dave Holland, Derek Bailey, and Kenny Wheeler. So that's the lineup for the first record. Yeah,
and
the first record I made. It's not bad, is it?
Yeah, well, at the time that was a UK supergroup, right?
Well, in our own lunchtimes, yeah. Probably.
Is that the only recording the five of you did have done together?
In fact, it's the only time that that specific group ever played together was to make the record. Wow. But there were any number of different combinations which carried on through.
Each one of them have a long history. Yeah.
Although Dave, it wasn't around for much longer after that than Miles.
Because he went to New York.
Yeah, stole him away from us.
But Kenny Wheeler was still here.
Kenny was still here, yeah.
Derek was still here and became your nemesis.
Well, at that the early point, I would say, because I started to rehearse duo things with Derek.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So everybody was a bit covering their options and building alliances in different places. And so the duo thing with Derek turned into the Music Improvisation Company. And the way we were thinking about that was to include some kind of electronics, some kind of live electronic thing, which at that point was still very simple analog electronic. And we had, first of all, a group with Jamie Muir, was a trio. Jamie Muir, you may know him from King Crimson, although you may say, what's King Crimson? I've got no idea. I mean, some of these references seem obvious to me, but I'm 73 years old.
Yeah, I thought we were a constitutional government.
Anyway, Jamie went on to make one record with King Crimson. And that's how he's best known. He's a very interesting drummer. And then we invited Hugh Davis, who's better known as he'd been an assistant of Stockhausen in Cologne, and was just back in London. And the little theatre club served as a place where people would go, and it was almost like a labour exchange, or like. Sort of our Windmill Street or whatever. What was that? Archer Street, the place where the dance band guys used to go and look for work.
Get jobs,
yeah. So people used to come there and, I'm really interested in what you're doing and we should get together. And it's the same way it works now,
You and Derek were sort of at the center of this company.
Yes, yes.
And then it became Derek's thing.
Yes.
When he announced company.
Yeah.
But
Music Improvisation Company was a group, and it was a collective group, and it came to a natural end when people went off to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then Derek announced company, which was his idea and was going to be, things he wanted to do, and that I would be a key part of that, but I wouldn't have too much say in. I could say yes or no, not much else.
But Derek famously always completely committed to improvisation, wrote a great book called Improvisation.
Yes.
And I'd imagine the duo, the Music Improvisation Company, is that what you?
Yes, yeah, that's what it was called.
The two of you were developing this idea of playing without preconceived materials.
Yeah.
And then... of course, like you said, everybody went off in different directions and a lot of people left the country. But how did you work on that kind of improvisation with Derek when you were in a duo and starting to add other elements like Jamie Muir and others?
Again, there is no theory. There's just the doing of it.
Right.
And you either hear a place for yourself or you think, I'd rather be somewhere else. And the gravitation to work with specific people is about what you hear in their music, which you feel complements or...
Do you feel like there was a challenge to make each performance different when you were in that period of really full... Let's just say improvisation.
Well, you hope that it's a balancing act, and that you want... You want a coherent sense of group identity. You want a space inside that group identity in which all the individuals' contributions are significant. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of balancing the known and the unknown. You know,
And probably from night to night, you'd have more or less.
Well, gradually, yeah, gradually you evolve a history. Well, you don't evolve a history, you make a history for mm-hmm. yourself. Mm-hmm. And you maybe develop some understandings which turn into dependable points of reference mm-hmm. Inside given performances. And in fact, in the end, then that became the issue where switch from friend to a nemesis, because I was very interested in groups that stayed together. And Derek wanted to change things by changing the personnel. Mm-hmm. So that was the distinction between the collective music improvisation company and the Derek Bailey's company, where he would select a particular combinations for his own reasons. To begin with, it was easier to understand, for me to understand what the thinking was, than it became later. And in fact, then towards the end, I felt I need to make a break and separate my affairs from his affairs, because we were standing, in my view, we started to represent different things.
Out of this, all this playing that you were doing,
yeah,
and developing it on the bandstand, essentially,
yeah,
as you do,
yeah,
you became solo playing became really important for you, and maybe that wasn't even a conscious choice. I don't know.
No, it was a conscious choice, and I resisted to begin with because I had theoretical objections. I thought the essence of free improvisation required more than one mind.
Dialogue, yeah.
More than one
mind
to be input into the structuring of the music. And I still consider that a crucial distinction. But through listening to friend and Derek, I'm sorry his name's going to crop up every so often, but he was a master musician, and he did start to do solo playing. And it was listening to his solo, the results of his solo playing, that made me realize, oh, there is a way that you can kind of have a dialogue either with the instrument, which was a key part of what his approach was, exploring the possibilities of the instrument, but you can also then layer different techniques or different elements so that you have a dialogue inside the music, which takes your sense of self away. It's almost as though it's not there. You're so transported by the mechanics of what you're doing and the layering effects that you can produce, mm-hmm. that it becomes also the chance elements where things don't quite happen under your control but become elements which reveal possibilities from the instrument which you hadn't intended, mm-hmm. but which you gradually learn to bring under control. Mm-hmm. This creates an improvisatory context. It's different from group improvisation, where you negotiate the music in real time with other minds. You may agree to disagree about this or that aspect, or you get dominant personalities and more reticent personalities. Kenny Wheeler was supposed to be a reticent personality, but he had a way of surviving. Let's put it that way. If you've ever seen the clip of Kenny playing, this is a YouTube clip, very badly done, but the music is amazing. Is with George Gruntz's big band with Lee Konitz.
And, I haven't seen this. No.
And they're playing one of Joe Henderson's. Joe's in the band as well, mm-hmm. playing one of Joe's tunes. And Kenny steps up and plays extraordinary solo and longer than you would expect in the context. Mm. And it's very fiery thing that Ken does, and in a way quite atypical. It's trumpet, not flugelhorn. And, mm-hmm. and I sent the link to a friend of mine, and he wrote back, "Not bad for an introvert."
So just going back a little bit to the free playing, not free playing, solo playing.
Mm.
Solo playing that you're saying you were inspired by Derek, and one of the inspirations was seeing him layer different elements and different techniques and different ideas over each other in order to create a sort of inner dialogue, which transformed you from being a quote-unquote solo performer to being just a participant in the unfolding of the material itself.
Exactement.
And would you say that you're always in dialogue with your materials? Would you say that's central to the way you play in every context?
To some extent. To some degree or another. Probably maximized in the solo situation.
But so it is 2018, and I put out the question a couple days ago on Twitter, I'm going to talk to Evan Parker, what should I ask him? And there's been some interesting responses, but one was, what?
Do you get paid for doing that? No, sorry.
No, I don't.
No, I meant the question.
Oh, you.
There's a backstory, but we'll come
back. I'm going to save that question for later, whether you're actually making a living. No. No, the question was, it was interesting. I'll see if I can paraphrase it. It's very much right key to this issue.
Okay.
What are you hearing when you're playing, when you're performing solo? And is it different to what you're hearing when you're playing with other musicians?
Oh yeah, of course. That's the point. You've already outlined exactly.
But I mean the act of listening. Like when you're listening to the material that you use unfold in this dialogue with the materials themselves.
Yes.
Is that different than the materials you get when you hear somebody standing over here playing?
Certainly, because I have to play in a way that relates to what the other people are playing.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean I have to take the responsibility on myself. If it's an idea of mine, it's a new idea. I've just put a combination of players together that haven't worked before. Maybe then I have to function like the decision maker in moments of indecision.
Director.
Yeah, yeah. But if I'm working with people that I've worked with a long time, there's two trios which I've worked with for a really long time. One is with Alex Schlippenbach, the piano player, and used to be Paul Lovens on the drums more, and the German guy, and now it's Paul Litton, who's actually an English man, but he's lived in Belgium for about 30 years. And they're good friends, and both fantastic drummers, very different styles in a way. It's almost like a Elvin versus Roy Haynes kind of situation, but maybe that's, yeah, I would say there's some truth to that.
When you play with those musicians?
Well, I've been playing with them for 30 years.
Yeah.
And so a lot of gigs and a lot of repetition and a lot of
history
and habits, you could say, and or habitual approaches, materials. He does that. Shall I do this? And things, habits get very concretized, as it were, solidified, and then they become annoying. And then you, instead of doing that when he does that or she does that, I'm going to sit here and do nothing, or I'm going to stand up and push myself to the you know, because you need to keep that dynamic of freshness.
Yeah.
And but you, it comes back to the thing I was saying. You need material which you can rely on, and you need avenues of growth out of that material. Where is this going? In order that the whole dynamic of a group can be developing and alive.
And I keep dwelling on the solo playing, just because you've done so much more of it than a lot of musicians.
Mm.
It's obviously been really important to you.
Mm.
And it also developed contemporaneously with your relationships with Alexander and Paul. And
well, the other group is with Barry Guy and Paul Litton. So at this point, it's very strange, because the Schlippenbach trio could work very well with Barry playing the bass. In fact, we've done a few things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
With both drummers. So we called it three plus three equals five, we called it, because it was, I was in both the trios. So the threes were the trios, but there were only five, so.
I'm not going to call you.
Well, you have to call a record something, don't you?
Really? Yeah. I'm blown away.
But, you know, it's striking. You see, what do you mean 3 plus 3 equals 5? No, it's 6. Okay.
Well, just to draw this area of the conversation to a close, you still do solo playing. I heard you do beautiful concert quite recently, actually, and it's
In the library,
in the
wonderful
medieval library in Bergamo, Italy, and it was just fantastic. But it's mesmerizing. It's and it sounds from what you're saying that's the goal. Also interiorly,
yes,
that you are mesmerized by the materials and by
because
the inner dialogue of how the materials you're using are unfolding.
Sometimes they make the analogy, or I've seen an analogy with if a centipede was trying to work out what every leg was doing, it could never walk. But somehow a centipede manages to walk. So maybe my brain's not quite as big as a centipede's, but it's and I don't have 100 legs, but you know, there's a lot going on in terms of cross fingerings and overtone manipulation.
Yeah.
And I'm not always sure what's doing what.
Mm-hmm.
I know that if I keep doing this, I can lock into a, I can loop more or less anything that I'm doing. So it's not a matter of random twiddling of fingers.
Yeah.
I can.
I wasn't going to suggest that.
No, you didn't suggest that. But, you know, my grandson's learning the oboe, and he does what he thinks is an impression of me.
Wow. That's great.
In fact, he made the first recording when he'd been playing for about a week. This is no problem. What he's doing is like, but lovely.
Wow.
So,
well, you'll have a new duo partner soon.
Well, I gave him a soprano, a curved soprano, but the teacher's not that happy. The oboe teacher's not, thinks it's
right.
Could be
loose.
Yeah, could wreck his oboe embouchure. Any doublers oboe?
Nobody plays oboe in this program. No. But circular breathing, obviously a big important element, and
yes.
You must have worked on that early on, and it also influenced, it fed this style.
Oh yeah, that's right? Crucial. Yeah, the idea of looping, everything being potentially loopable, depends crucially on circular breathing. Yeah, but my original impulse to develop or learn the technique was in the Music Improvisation Company with Derek and Hugh Davis. Hugh used to play self-made instruments, and one of the things he did was clamp a string to a table with a pickup, so the string could be very long, and he'd pluck that boing, or get some feedback happening, and Derek was master of controlled feedback as well, so they could hit chords and sustain indefinitely. And if I'm playing in the chord and then have to give up because I've run out
of
breath, then that was the impetus for me to
was there learn any the manual, any like resource that you went to learn it, or did you figure it out on your own?
I don't agree with most of what the books say. The few books that I've read about it, and the straw in the glass of water is really a red herring. Imagine a red herring in a glass of water.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and a straw. Don't suck. Blow.
So you learned it on your own. You learned it yourself.
Yes.
And the techniques that you have seen described, no one particular.
Well, you know, there's only one way you can do it.
Just do it.
You don't. You have to push for a bit while you breathe in. That's right. All there is to it. And until you can do that, the saxophone is irrelevant. But you...
You hear that, everybody? Wow.
You can do that at the bus stop. You don't have to make the farting noise, even. You know, just sustain the pressure there and breathe in. Until you can do that, you're just kidding yourself. The saxophone's a waste of time.
I do want to talk about composition, because we've been talking so much about improvisation and spontaneous music and et cetera, et cetera. And
this is where it gets meaty.
Well, I wonder. I mean, I wonder, after hearing you talk, I wonder if it's all part of the same process for you.
I don't do it
in the doing, and you get up and you...
I talk about... in fact, Alex sent a paper, a short paper that I wrote to the GEMA in Germany. This GEMA is the equivalent of PRS, because we were trying to get the rates upped for improvised music, which in Germany is treated like pop music, and also in this country is treated like light light, and the BBC too.
Light, and the reason that that's important is that popular music pays at a much lower rate for performances than so-called serious music.
Yeah,
does.
Yeah. So the I think the paper was called Improvisation as Compositional Method, something like that. So rather serious. And just making the argument that this, when you finish with a recording, that's it. It's a fixed piece of music. The idea that music can only exist first as a score and then as a sounding thing comes from a different era. But so do those organizations. You know, they're very Victorian in the way they do their business and the way.
I've been watching that show, Victoria, and I have to say, it's really good. I love it. I mean, I hate the publishing companies from that period, but other than that, the show is great. But to take it back to the composition itself, you work with ensembles.
Yes.
Of string players and wind players and electronic musicians and percussion and going into various different size ensembles with pieces.
Yes.
That you have imagined beforehand, and there's material on paper that you present to the musicians. I call that composition.
Yes.
And yet,
fair enough.
And yet, I, from what I understand, or from not knowing you that well, but from observing from the outside, you know, there's also still a commitment to improvisation, to the process of the thing unfolding.
Oh yeah. When you see what's on the cards that I give out. There's then you know, it's got down to a postcard for
an entire score.
For
10
minutes.
Section.
10 uh-huh. minutes, you know, maybe 6 cards for an hour. Because I can't stand all that shuffling. And
so, but each piece that you write, do you come up with a different way of thinking about notating the material?
Yes.
And would you say that the way that you notate is germane to the content of the piece itself?
It's more about the personnel and instrumentation and personnel. You know, I don't pick a flute player without knowing a flute. I don't write for flute without knowing who the flute player will be. I don't write for bass clarinet without.
So your notation of your compositions is really based around the personalities that are going to be there and what they're going to do and how they're going to interact with
absolutely.
Your idea.
That's it. Combinations. So. I found a very nice combination of with Ned Rothenberg playing shakuhachi and Peter Evans playing muted trumpet. Mm-hmm. I don't think Peter likes playing muted trumpet that
much. Is that
much.
Right?
I don't know. But that worked really well. So, you know, different things like that where you stumble on something and basically you're saying, hey, do that for a bit.
Now, when you write these pieces and you bring them to the ensemble, do you write a part for yourself? Or do you just sort of know what you're going to do?
Yeah, I have the same kind of part as everybody else, but it just says play here, you know, or don't play here.
Mm-hmm.
Or play with someone.
So you know what you're going to...
It's about combinations. It's very much about specifics of instrument color and personality of player.
So the clash of timbres is the basis of how you configure these mostly.
Yes and no. I don't know. Not being difficult, but
No.
I think of the two things that.
I think it's a hard thing.
It's
to talk
when
about.
People ask, "Can you do you think of the line first or the harmony?"
Mm-hmm.
And he's always looked a bit puzzled when people,
right, sure.
because it's both things working along at the same time. And when I think about a flute, am I thinking about the flute or am I thinking about a specific player, or a drums, or a drummer, or and with the drummers, which set Paul Litton, for example, has about 3 different approaches which are built into. Specific instruments, so I can say bring that one, but bring some wood blocks, or bring just play the house drums, and you know bring but
some
and
small percussion.
Yeah, right. He'll bring his cymbals and a box of stuff. So
right, so using his language.
Yeah.
So this we were talking about this in a session yesterday. So at the point when the piece is quote unquote finished, or which I guess is the recording date, you know, when it goes on tape, that's becomes the how much would you say is composed and how much is improvised? I guess it's the same question about that you were just talking about, Kenny.
Well, in the sense that everybody would be encouraged only to do something that made sense to them.
Mm.
These are compositional decisions. Where it gets complicated is that the idea of one mind composing and multi-mind composing, and I think we said in the, I may have said yesterday in the conversation, that I think free improvising is still in its infancy in that way, but it's attracting higher and higher levels of talent and ability. Some remarkable people coming into the scene, and they will make the decisions for where it goes next. And I don't know.
But do you?
I personally think that electronics and computers will become more and more important,
mm-hmm.
because they're just the options are phenomenal. The and some people now are playing laptops like. Well, we both know Ikue.
Ikue Mori.
Ikue Mori is just a genius. I think she started out as a drummer in a punk rock band called DNA a long time ago. And she plays the laptop in a way which is so... there's no latency in what she's doing. It's as though it's a piano keyboard. It's not a piano keyboard. She's making decisions about software, what... sampling, all of this stuff, but the control is so exquisite that you don't think anything except how can I play with this. It's so beautiful, you know, it doesn't need me, but I want to play with it. It makes me sound better.
I've been playing with her for many years,
yeah,
and I have to say that every time I play with her the vocabulary has expanded.
Yeah.
I never have the feeling like, oh, there's that sound again.
It's
always something new and unexpected.
Yeah.
Which, to bring that from a computer, takes a lot of human ingenuity.
She's got the...
George Lewis also is doing a lot of great work. And many others, of course. But let me just, to bring it back to the question of freedom versus composition, if there is even a versus in there.
Yeah.
You know, you're writing for improvisers in a really interesting way by setting up these... meetings of different textures and different interactions with material, and yet you're working with improvisers, right? So would you still consider that free improvisation?
I don't care anymore, you know. Not that I did have that hang up about multi, it needs to have more than one mind input into it for free improvisation to happen. If you're just playing your music solo, it's composition. How can it be anything else?
So in other words, when you play solo saxophone, you don't consider that improvisation?
Well, I gave you my rationale for that. Listening to Derek, thinking about multi-mindedness and all the rest of it, and that does seem to be what happens when you play with yourself. Excuse me. Unintended.
But you
are forced to have massive feedback from what you hear into what you do next.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody else is going to, there's no get out, you know, nobody's going to get you off the hook. You've made a hook. Mm-hmm. You have to hang and swing on it until that's enough.
And that's not improvisation for you.
It is, but it's a very different kind of improvising. And anyway, improvising for me is composition.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to get drawn by, I mean, if you want to make a distinction, you can talk about notation. But even notation, I mean, Busoni wrote very well on this subject.
Mm.
It starts with an idea in the mind. Music starts with an idea in the mind. And you can make a memoir, you can write stuff on paper, of course you can. It's great. And you can employ the hierarchical structures, the orchestras, these, you know, where people know their place. I was terrified to learn from Meyer Homburger, the great Baroque violinist, that in German they talk about tutti Schweine. I don't know if you know that expression or there's an English equivalent, but it means the rank and file players. They're called tutti pigs in German orchestras, as opposed to the soloists and so on. So, you know, you're dealing with a hierarchy. As soon as you write for any, okay, this is a part for trumpet, this is a part for saxophone, it becomes then something less about the specifics of the situation. So then the individuals can still shine through, you know, the way your pieces are organized. You can take them to different places and they will sound differently because there's huge space for individual contributions. And, you know, in this place, oh, the drummer, listen to the drummer on this one. Oh, no, the bass trombone, is he here?
No, he don't care.
No, he shouldn't be, because I'm going to embarrass him, but what a sound that guy's got. It's fantastic. And then you hear what a bass trombone is. Very good. Yeah. I mean, you must be pleased to have him holding up the.
I thought he would come to my talk with you, but
you know, no,
he's not everything.
I'm not going to say he's too busy practicing, but well, he knows what he can do already, and
And I would just say that, you know, in your projects, you're at this point inviting some very special musicians.
Incredible players.
People, and so that must be a part of when you're dreaming up what the, you know, like you said, all musical events come from inside your mind and your musical imagination, and the freedom to think up those things and do them and have them realized by such interesting players must be a great satisfaction.
It's a remarkable situation to be in, you know. And I can see that it's just going to get more and more amazing with I won't be around for that much longer, but it's...
Oh, yes, you will. And now that you've been at the Royal Academy, we're going to push for your knighthood. Sir Evan.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with me about this. I just learned so much, and I feel like we just scratched the surface, but I know that you have a lot of other things that you need to do, and I just want to say thank you, and thanks to everybody here for being in the room. And
thank you very much.